still following us?
Yes.
Is there one of them?
Hmm?
Is he looking at us?
Hmm?
Does he have just one hand on the steering wheel?
Mm-hmm.
When you hear something that sounds like a gunshot, drive.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Agency Podcast. Eugene Napick here on 27th Street in Toronto.
And Candy Minx here on 27th Street in Toronto.
Yes.
I can't believe we're in the same room and I'm more nervous now than any time when I'm far away from you. It's going to be weird to look at your pretty blue eyes and try and talk.
Yes, Candy is all quarantined and is staying with us for a period of time.
That's
here,
right.
Joining the family.
That's right.
And so we'll be podcasting from the same room. Hard to believe.
We're sharing a mic. We've leaned in. And also we're watching some of the same things. So we're going to really be easy to talk about.
That's right,
stuff.
At the same time.
At the same time. It's just kind of surreal after a year of podcasting. More than a year.
It sure is, and we haven't actually seen one another in quite some time.
A long time.
You know, we
a
have
year.
Had this pandemic, and yep. Plus we live in different cities, and it's not always easy to visit one another. So it's a real treat for us to be able to get together and podcast here.
Yeah, and I think it might even help with talking over each other and not interrupting, because I can actually see when you're about to say something or when you're on a roll.
That's right. Which we could, if we filmed video when we podcast, we could sort of overcome some of that. But we seem to have a block about doing the video.
And it slowed down some of, didn't it sluggish up our computers a bit?
It may have.
Yeah, okay. I want to say welcome to any new listeners. If you're out there, hi. And to friendly, familiar faces as well.
Yes, we thank you for sticking with us and continuing to come back and visit the podcast. You may hear in the background, George is very vocal this morning. George, our Newfoundland dog, he's decided that he's going to join the podcast and make all kinds of weird noises in the background.
I thought King Kong had walked in the building or something. Like, he's literally talking like an old man or something like that.
He is. Mm-hmm. He is. And I'm sure that he'll settle down.
He's still going.
Okay, George, why don't you come here and join the podcast?
Instead of yelling from the other room.
It's like, I don't want to join the podcast. I want to just make noise and disturb the podcast.
It's also weird because I can see your notes. I can't really read them, but I can see your notes. Oh, so it's I'm seen behind the curtain.
It's like Scrabble, right?
It's like
you have to hide your notes.
We haven't played Scrabble. We haven't played any board games yet.
That's right. We're going to do it, though.
All right, we will.
Because we have Candy and I have a long tradition of game playing. Mm-hmm. There was a time in which we played a lot of Hearts.
Yes, we did. I lost a lot of games.
Hearts.
I lost my heart.
And then Canasta.
Oh, Canasta played, was such a fun phase.
We played a lot of Canasta and Cribbage.
Cribbage. Yeah.
And Scrabble.
And Scrabble. Very good things. The Go didn't take with me. You tried. I'm not going to say I'm not going to play Go someday. I like the
But there
the
is
poetry.
A Go board set up upstairs, and I have mentioned that Go lessons are available.
I might do it. I might take you up on it.
Candy's husband, Stag, was watching a Go video yesterday.
He was. For a
long and
time.
It was a video translation from Japanese Go TV show. So it had the two players, one of whom was Cho Chikan, who's a South Korean player who moved to Japan as a boy. And it has a commentator and a host, and they speak in Japanese. So you see you watch the players, the excitement that is Go on television, which is two players staring at a Go board, mm-hmm. and they make moves, and then they show the commentators and the host, and they explain the right. moves.
I thought it was compelling.
Stagg was transfixed by it. Transfixed. I don't think he understood a word they were talking
no.
about.
No, not at all. It's a pretty cold, crisp day out there. I went to the grocery store this morning, the nightclub, as I like to call it, and it was a heavenly experience going into the grocery store by myself just today and Shoppers Drug Mart. I love going to a drugstore. So that was a lot of fun.
This is what the pandemic has done to
us. I know. Totally done to us.
Excitement is going to a drugstore.
And also, though, this is pretty exciting. I mean, we've seen a lot of people that we haven't seen normally. So I it's almost like, is this real? Are we really seeing Sheila and Eugene? This is like being on drugs. Am I really seeing family? Am I seeing my daughter? Am I seeing our friends? It's just crazy. Yes, you are. And Toronto is still under closed except for essential shopping. Just for anyone who's listening anywhere else, there's only essential shopping.
So that means grocery stores, there's takeout restaurants, there's LCBO, there's mm-hmm. weed stores, mm-hmm. they're all open. And that's the drugstores. Our printer is operating for Squeezebox Man.
Oh, good.
Squeezebox Man issue 5 is at the printer.
All right.
And if anyone is interested in any of the issues of Squeezebox Man, mm-hmm. you can email me at 27th Street Press. That's 27th Street Press at gmail.com. And we can hook you up.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I got so many things in my mind that I want to talk about. One is the museums, but we watched Corporate. We started watching Corporate.
Oh, Corporate, my God. We started watching Corporate and I screamed out, I've worked with these people!
Okay, now is that on HBO?
I think it's
HBO. We found it on Crave and it's shot, it's about an office, but it's not like The Office, except that it's office people. But it's not that kind of comedy. It's a little darker and it's physically darker. It seems like they work in a hollow building, more like the Matrix, with shadows and bad lighting.
Yes, it's just like with millions of cubicles and really bad fluorescent lighting, and it's they're living this horrible, meaningless existence in this corporate environment, and it's a corporation that appears to make everything, including weapons.
True.
And we watched the other night an episode called "The PowerPoint of Death," and I have to tell you, I have it in for PowerPoint. Yeah, I think PowerPoint is such a destructive force in our corporate environment. Because what happens is people make these PowerPoint decks. And the first thing they do is, because they have all this knowledge in their head and they mm-hmm. want to get it out, mm-hmm. they think they need to put everything from their head onto the PowerPoint slide. So people will have like a graph with 10,000 numbers on it and they're really tiny, and then they're in the meeting and they project the graph and the first thing they say is, well, it's a little bit small to see this, but
yeah.
And I want to throw something at them and scream out, you know, if it's too small to see, why do you make us look at it?
Right.
Right?
Right.
PowerPoint is just, it drives me completely mad. I hate PowerPoint. And then even worse is when you have someone who writes all his knowledge on his slides, and then he'll have a pointer and he'll turn his back to his audience and read his slides. Oh, used to drive me crazy when I was in the working world.
Right. Well, I believe the way to make power, I like things to increase. So I like to sneak in extra information, as much information as possible. I'm almost evil and incorrigible. So I think your PowerPoint, and I watch a lot of them at the conferences, and I will say a lot of people do some creative things, and there's a lot of people very sensitive in education about how to convey knowledge. So I would say there's a lot of innovation in those PowerPoint presentations at the pop culture convention, but I like to have something completely that I'm not talking about on the screen. And that's giving different information than what I'm talking about. But you made a great point years ago about when you said don't do a PowerPoint, and I don't. I've done video, mostly video, but
It's more engaging to talk to people.
It's way more engaging to talk to people, and it makes you work a bit better. And you work on the missing points, because you can tell people's faces if they're understanding you or not, if you've gone too fast or gone too slow. So yeah, PowerPoint, the thing is, you just turn your brain off. It goes to mush when you watch PowerPoint.
The thing
That's
is
what you said.
That human beings can absorb something like 7 to 9 things at once.
Yeah.
And so that could be, you could sort of have rules. No more than 7 words.
Mm-hmm.
No words with more than 7 letters.
Mm-hmm,
no more than 7 pictures.
Yeah.
Because there's only so much. If you put out 20 items of anything on a table and look at them for the amount of time you look at a PowerPoint slide and then try to remember what was on the table, you might remember 5 of them.
Right.
You might remember the 5 least important. So if you actually want to get something across, you put up what's most important. I think. Anyway, in corporate, they were trying to get a gig supplying a war with guns and ammunition, and so they did. The bullet points were bullets. Everybody loved the bullets. Bullets.
Yeah. And there's not one manager. There's 2 very smarmy Uriah Heep type. Well, the one guy, he's like Uriah Heep out of Dickens, right? And there are 2 managers that are just, they're disgusting.
These guys are junior managers in training.
Okay.
And they get all the shit jobs.
Yeah.
You know, in one of the episodes, like, they're tasked with firing someone. Mm-hmm. And the HR person gets all excited. It's like, oh, it's your first firing.
Oh, that's the 2 young guys.
Oh, the 2 young
guys.
Yes.
I'm talking about the woman and man.
Oh, the woman and man. They're horrible.
I mean, those 2 guys are our heroes, I think. If there are any heroes in the show, and one of them keeps saying, that's because life is meaningless about anything. But, and then the other guy, he's a very sensitive young man, and so this is kind of traumatic for him. He shouldn't probably be in an office.
No, he shouldn't be at all.
He maybe needs a different job. But the 2 managers that are running this thing, they're just like insidiously.
Oh, they're just completely horrible.
Oh, they really are.
And the CEO of the company is Lance Reddick.
Oh, yeah. And
from
amazing.
From The Wire.
He's amazing.
He was the lieutenant in The Wire.
Right. He's so good. And everyone is beautifully cast. It does look really good. The suits are amazing. I highly recommend it. It's funny as hell.
It's really, really
funny.
It's
really, really funny.
And especially if you've worked in a corporate environment, because the first thing that happens is you recognize people.
Yeah.
It's, oh, I worked with him.
Yeah.
What an asshole.
Right. Right. And I mean, it's also very different than being in a restaurant. Restaurants have their own kind of dynamic, but it's not
it's very much the corporate culture.
This is so
right?
corporate. Yeah. Yeah, corporate. And you know, that feeds into retail. You can see it in retail. They try to make people in retail act like they're in a corporate office. But anyway, highly recommend it. I watched something on my own because I couldn't sleep a couple times. I've had good sleeps, but I woke up a little bit and I got hooked onto this thing called Room 2806, The Accusation. And it's about Dominic Strauss-Kahn in 2011. Do you remember? He was the head of IMF. French guy got charged with sexual harassment and rape.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a documentary on Netflix right now. And is it ever good? It's interesting because, of course, that's before Me Too. And it's before Weinstein. And it's kind of considered to be the case that turned it on and got it going, right? And so it's very good. Even one of the lawyers, I wrote down his name, Wigdur. He actually is the prosecutor. He was a prosecutor for Strauss-Kahn, but he's a prosecutor for Weinstein now. So he's still working in that realm. And there's so many people interviewed. There's the security guards. There are the women involved. There was a woman that came out from years before this. I had not realized it was such a complex case. I thought it was pretty, you know, rich people, another rich guy who has perversions or something, or was a rapist. Yeah, I thought, oh, you know, Tuesday, you know, but it was really a complex case where some people thought it was a conspiracy because he was a socialist and he was helping. They had done a lot of good things after the economic crash in 2008. They had done a lot of recovery. So for this guy to be hit, some people believed it was Sarkozy. The current president of France, trying to keep his place. And then people, because Strauss-Kahn was assumed to be the next president of France. But mind you, I love the current president. I think everything came out good because he should be the president. He's better than all these guys.
Okay.
But what a great sexual harassment, intrigue, tragedy. And then just his wife. He married a woman. It was like his third wife. And she was so insanely rich. that he could go out with a monitor. They didn't want to let him out of the being arrested. Interesting things that they said, that the outcry is part of the investigation. So anyone you outcry to is really a valuable part of gathering evidence, because you're in the moment. And if I told you something and then I told Stagg and then I told Sheila, your testimony would be super important because you were right there in the moment. And I thought that was very respectful to see how the police had handled it. And there was one scene where the security guards of the hotel, they interview them, they interview almost everybody and private investigators. In one of the cameras, security cameras, you see these two guys go in the side room and hug. And it's a very bizarre thing, because one fellow, he wrote an article saying, see, this proves it was a setup to trap the IMF and get rid of him as a president, that she was set up to do this, to trap him.
Then,
yeah, I don't think it was that at all. These guys, I took it as, oh my God, they're so proud of that they were able to accomplish listening to her and getting the police to come and to support their job. They took their job as security very, very seriously. And they did do a sports hug in a back room, and they knew where every camera was. It wasn't like they were trying to keep that secret. They didn't do it in front of the rape victim or alleged rape victim. Anyway, a great series. I still have one more episode. I'd love to hear what anybody else has to say. I would recommend it. It's a compelling documentary and really well done. A lot of subtitles, a lot of French, but it's very, very good. It's easy to follow.
Okay. Speaking of international intrigue, on the heels of having read that wonderful John le Carré memoir, I had this other book by John le Carré that I got from in front of our house. There's we have a book box or one of those little free libraries, and a John le Carré book appeared in there. So I grabbed it, and it was called A Perfect Spy. It was from the mid 80s. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I noticed about it is that one of the characters, the father of the perfect spy, is based on the father of John le Carré, who was a con man. So in the memoir, he writes at length towards the end of the memoir about his experiences with his father, who was an honest-to-God con man in and out of jail for much of his life, full of lies all the time. Mm-hmm. So I thought that's going to be pretty interesting to read this book and see how he deals with that. And I had started to read this book actually some time ago, and then I just put it down about 25 pages in. Mm-hmm. I found it just hard to penetrate. And I thought, now that just on the heels of the the memoir, I'm going to be able to really enjoy this this book. I got the same 25 pages in, and I hit the same wall. I just could not read another page. It's like get to the point, John. Come on, get to the point. I mean, he really drifts.
Yeah.
And I know that it's a big book. It's like 500 pages, and he's building the character. Mm-hmm. And I get that, but I just couldn't get past this point. Wow. And maybe if I got past this little point, I would be off to the races. Mm-hmm. You know, when I read another of his books, The Night Manager, I found there was a bit early on that was sort of impenetrable too. And once I broke through that, the book was fine.
Right. Interesting.
So I don't know that I'm going to try a third shot at A Perfect Spy, though.
Yeah.
It's hard to say.
Yeah. Well, that does sort of show maybe a little bit of his, maybe he had a little bit of a hero thing to be working for law enforcement because his dad had been basically duplicitous. Maybe.
I think he was recruited as a young man too. I think at that time, you didn't apply to a spy agency.
Right.
It's like, hi, I'd like to be a spy.
Right. They found you.
They find you. Yeah. They select you and recruit you.
They can see you in school.
I've been waiting actually to be recruited for some time because I think I would be an excellent spy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking forward to that.
Well, no one would suspect that a violin, banjo playing musician, go player would be. Now, an international go player might be a good spy because you'd have a great cover.
Right.
One of the spies I know, he was always at corporations and had pamphlets and brochures. He was always portraying the role of being at conferences and, promoting a product. All fake.
My Uncle Harold and my Aunt Virginia were spies. They, as a young man, my Uncle Harold married a woman named Virginia, and they moved to America. And from America, they went to, after the Second World War, they went to, from New York to Paris, and Virginia had a job with the American embassy.
First sign of a spy.
That's right. and they got to know all the bohos. They got to know Alice Toklas after Gertrude Stein had passed. And they became very, very friendly with her, and they summered with her for several summers. And Harold, who ostensibly was studying, he was a piano prodigy, and he was studying music in France, ostensibly. He also studied French cooking, and he became an expert French chef. And he would cook for Alice and all of her friends.
Well, they had the munchies.
I guess they did. I guess they did. And yeah, I know Alice was into the hash brownies. And, you know, you see pictures. One of the things you see in all the pictures of Harold and Alice and all those people is they're all smoking.
Yeah, that's funny.
And apparently one of the ways that they ingratiated themselves to the bohos is that Virginia from the American embassy had the unending supply of American cigarettes, which was made them very popular. But apparently they were spying, reporting, I guess, on those communist bohemian artist types. And I don't know too many details about it, except that, you know, many years later, they were afraid when the phone rang. They didn't want to do more jobs for the CIA, and they were under some pressure to do so. I wish that I knew more about Harold and his life, because I didn't really know him. You know, he was like legend in our family. He was legitimately a master musician. He wrote a book on counterpoint. He was very well known as a teacher. He ran an art gallery in New York. There was a spread on him in Life magazine. He wrote a book on French cooking called Haute Cuisine Without Help. I've tried to cook things from his book. It's tremendously complicated. I thought big on cooking the French cooking stuff. But I'll go back to it one day maybe and learn to cook some of those things.
I love French food, one of my favorites.
I remember when I was a boy, Harold, without Virginia, Harold came from New York to visit us, and he was going to cook us dinner. I can remember him, we had an upright piano, and I can remember him playing beautiful piano in our home, and he was going to cook dinner for us, and he dispatched my father and my brother to go out and catch some trout for dinner. Which they did. Off they went, and they came back with a mess of trout for dinner. And
that's great.
And I can remember that Harold cooked these trout with almonds, and they were tremendously tasty. And that's really all I can remember in terms of interaction with him.
It's weird because something, and we've talked about this, I always wonder, what did it feel like to be monitoring people who were bohemian or artsy, you know, of all the things you think. The thing is, I guess socialism is kind of associated, and leftism and anti-fascism is associated with the ethics of art or art making, you know. It's such a weird connection. And yet to watch that, you know, I wonder how they ever felt politically.
Well, and I had, you know, it was known in the family that they were involved with this, but you don't know what's true and what isn't true, of course. And years later, in, I think it was the New Yorker magazine.
Harper's magazine.
No, I think it was,
the New Yorker. Because I got that from George. Hi, George.
There was an article about Alice and Gertrude getting through the war.
Okay.
Because they... Two Jewish lesbians in France during the war, they had to be protected if they were going to get through the war alive. And they were. There was a network of people who were protecting people
Would that have been maybe Harold and?
Well, I don't know. I know that they were certainly aware and may have been part of that network. I really don't know.
Right.
But they were mentioned in this article, and the fellow who wrote the article said, "I guess it's okay to say now because both Harold and Virginia are long dead and gone. But they were both American spies."
Yeah, I know, because George had this, and I read it at his place and brought it to you. I said, "George, can I take your magazine? Because I'm going to freak out. It's Eugene's." Family is mentioned in here, and it's finally we can say so. We can finally say it, you know. Yeah, do you still have that? Must be kicking around here somewhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
somewhere around here, I have a copy of that kicking around.
I'm gonna see if I can find it online too. Maybe share it with people. It's a great article,
it's pretty interesting. It shows that, you know, my relatives who were pretty humble working class folks here in Toronto, there were some sort of remarkable people in our family who had these remarkable lives.
Oh my God, absolutely.
The other thing is Harold and his brother, Gene, who I was named after, married two women who were sisters, who were their first cousins.
So cute.
Virginia and Eleanor. And they all moved to the States. And Harold and Virginia went to New York and then France and then much later back to New York. Mm-hmm. And Jean and Eleanor moved to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And Jean had learned about repairing violins from my grandpa who made violins and repaired violins. And he got a job with a little company called Wurlitzer, in which he had an opportunity to work on really, really high-end historical violins. Mm. So he became quite an expert at that. And from Wurlitzer, he moved on to a violin shop called the Warren Violin Shop in Chicago. Worked for them for some time and then opened his own workshop. He moved to an area around Chesterton, Illinois, and had his own workshop there where he made quite a number of very high-end violins and violas. And a few years ago, I wanted to know about him, and it was sort of in the back of my mind. And I tuned into YouTube one day. I was watching an interview with the performer David Bromberg, and they were interviewing him about having left the music business. He left music business for over 20 years. He was kind of burned out and felt he was really no longer a musician anymore, and he needed another life. And he learned to make violins, and he became one of the experts on American-made violins. And I heard this interview, and I thought, well, he has this violin shop in Delaware, I think Wilmington, Delaware. And I thought, I'm going to email him at the shop. Now, there's no way David Bromberg is ever going to reply to me. I mean, he's one of my musical heroes. He's not going to reply to me. But I emailed him anyway, because, what have you got to lose? So
nothing.
I got a reply back the next day from David Bromberg. And he said, you know, I've never seen any of your Uncle Gene's violins, but I know his name because he used to hang out in the Warren shop, and he remembered Gene's name being mentioned many times there because he had worked there for years. And I guess in his own way was kind of a legend in the shop. So David Bromberg put me in touch with the original owner of the shop. And I emailed her at the shop, and I got a response from somebody at the shop saying, please be patient. Mrs. Warren is putting together a response for you. Mm-hmm. And like a week or so later, in the mail, I get this package, and the package has pictures of my uncle and my aunt, Jean and Eleanor, on their farm with Eleanor's sculptures and Jean's violins and violas, and pictures of Mr. and Mrs. Warren with Jean and Eleanor. And it was full of stories that she remembered. She remembered going for dinners and how Jean liked to bake and cook. And and really stories about their fond memories of their old friends. So it was really beautiful that she sent me that. And when they passed, they bequeathed everything in Jean's workshop, I think, to the University of Illinois. And so they have a collection. And
we got to go see that.
And any money that he had, they made a scholarship at the university for aspiring musicians.
That is so cool.
So, yeah, it is.
You come by it honestly. You come by your interests honestly. Your family was very curious family.
They were a very curious family. You know, my grandparents, my grandpa was in the glove business in Chicago. And he, for some reason, they moved up to Canada. And I never really found out why it was they moved to Canada. They moved to Montreal and then later to Toronto. And they opened a shop on Dundas Street in Toronto called the Queen City Leatherworks. At that time, two cities were considered twin cities, Toronto and Buffalo, and they were called the Queen Cities. Mm. So Grandpa in the 20s opened the Queen City Leatherworks, and it was like a storefront, and behind the storefront where they sold all the gloves, mm-hmm. as well as coveralls and overalls and all the things for the railway men, because the junction was the junction of railway lines, right. And it was where all the railway men were. So they had the storefront, and behind the storefront they had the big sewing machines for sewing the gloves. And then in the basement there were also some stomping machines for stomping out the leather.
That's not my phone.
Excuse that little interruption. I believe that was Service Canada with a warrant for my arrest.
Yes, I think it was.
I think it was one of those scams.
Yeah.
In any case, behind that, they had a big old living room, and my grandma always had an old cranky collie dog there that I remember. And then there was the kitchen, and upstairs were the bedrooms. And when I was a boy, my grandpa was quite old, and he mostly stayed upstairs in his room. And I remember going up to visit him. I really loved. I would sit on his knee, and he'd tell me stories
That kind of thing.
So in the family,
cozy.
All the boys in the family, they're all boys except my Auntie Madeline.
Mm-hmm.
They all played music. So my dad played sax and clarinet and drums. And when he wasn't playing poker and betting the ponies, right. He had a swing band. And they used to play in cottage country at resorts, cool. And that kind of thing.
So cool.
And my Uncle Billy, I think, played cello. And Gene was learning to make violins. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Grandpa also played violin. So it was a very musical family. And Harold, of course, was a piano prodigy.
Right.
And the family pooled a lot of resources to get a lot of sacrifice in the family to get a proper music education for Harold, because he was clearly the musical genius in the family, and they wanted to support that. So, yeah, on my dad's side, there was a lot of music, a whole musical tradition. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, so when I was
very
a kid,
very old-fashioned to have your family play music together. It's very nice.
When I was a kid, my dad used to say, "Son, you must have music in you, because none of it's ever come out." My revenge was I learned to play the button accordion.
That's right. That's right. Good for you. Wow.
Yeah, good family stuff. Stories, huh?
Family stories. You know, there's a family story, you know, you get these stories, and it's making me think of the movie we watched the other night where David Fincher has made his father's script.
That's right.
And a lot of the experience, it's Mank, which is short for, it's a nickname for Herman Mankiewicz, and everyone called him Mank, and it's about, it's black and white, it's on Netflix, it's brand new. And I guess his father was very compelled by the mythology around Citizen Kane and the writing of Citizen Kane, originally titled American. So I think that the first impression I had was that it's a labor of love.
Yes.
To his father, who didn't...
And it's lovingly made.
And it's lovingly
Every
made.
Every shot is very carefully set up and beautifully made. It's in black and white. Mm-hmm. The cinematography is really stunning in it, in the whole film. It's really gorgeous. the film is, I think it's a deeply flawed film, and the big flaw is around pacing.
Yeah, I agree.
It's highly stylized. The scenes are highly stylized. Mm-hmm. The dialogue's highly stylized. Yep. And that,
all of that I like.
But the problem with the stylized dialogue is it doesn't have drive.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to keep up with it or to get in, because you're so enamored by the witty repartee that you're not really sure what they're saying sometimes. Yes. Almost. That was me.
The one thing that I really didn't know, and I'm certainly no expert on that early film history,
right.
But I had no idea that, well, I was aware that Citizen Kane was really about William Randolph Hearst. I had no idea. They all knew Hearst.
At least Mankiewicz did.
Yeah. And there was this political split that happened.
Yeah.
And that's what really drove the writing.
Yes.
It was pretty fascinating.
It is fascinating. And I hope, I don't think it's going to ruin this to say it, because you almost want to know this when you go into it. I want to see a movie about Upton Sinclair. I don't know if there is one, but he has a very small part in it where you see him speaking in the 1934, I don't know, it's a race in California. And he really had a political side. He's a socialist and a poet and a writer. And he's played for 1 second, and this is brilliant, by Bill Nye, the science guy.
I didn't realize that.
Is that Bill Nye? When we were watching, I went, yeah.
Oh,
which
wow.
is a very interesting touch, because it means something now, maybe more than it would have been made. Now, this was originally David Fincher, who is one of my very favorite directors. He can do no wrong, in my opinion. So it was a little painful to see that this had a very stilted pacing on it. It was difficult for me to get into it because of that pacing, but gorgeous to look at. But his dad had written it. I don't think it would have been quite the same if he hadn't cast Bill Nye, because we're looking at a world right now where Upton Sinclair was trying to be ethical. He had exposed the meatpacking corruption in Chicago in 1906, and he'd written an expose like Hunter S. Thompson almost. He was kind of the Hunter S. Thompson of his time, and people hated him because he was socialist. And then a few years after he did this expose, they developed the FDA. To monitor food making. Everything he would write into an expose actually changed the country. It changed the way we made things, from coal production.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he was running for California, he was very concerned about poverty and immigrants and workers' rights. And he was going to change things. And the film industry was completely freaked out, because what we think of as liberal Hollywood right now, at the time back then, these were capitalist filmmakers. They owned every actor. They owned all the lots.
That's right. And as well, it was depicted in this film as the ultimate old boys club.
Well,
where
said.
You scene after scene after scene, you would see 15 men in a room smoking cigars. Mm-hmm. And there's one of these scenes in which all the men are in this room and there's one woman, and all she's wearing is pasties.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh,
shocking.
Yeah, that's quite the image,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, the thing is, you know, you don't have to know this to enjoy this film. And I think it actually will make it more enjoyable, because it's the history around this story that's really interesting. So Mankiewicz was hired by Orson Welles and MGM, I think. I hope I'm right on that, to write the script about, you know, Orson Welles had given him a bunch of notes. And what happened was, I don't know if Orson Welles told him base it on Hearst. I think Mankiewicz thought of it. He thought of his relationship with who he saw at parties, Hearst, and the way he worked in the world. And he was pissed off from years earlier. Part of that piss off is because the film companies made fake news. Before we called it fake news, they made these propaganda films to dismiss and disqualify Upton Sinclair. Because they were afraid he would maybe, I don't know if they called
it
unions,
get elected.
But he might get elected, and that would change their hold on the way they ran their businesses. And so they made scandalous films about him, public service announcements and that. And Mankiewicz would have been part of that, because
yes.
He worked for it. So I think we see him as an alcoholic. He resolves his guilt over being involved in such a propaganda machine. He was not a socialist, but he was liberal. And I think that he saw the patriarchy and capitalism America.
And it seems as if he had to write this script.
Yeah.
And the script was he knew it was probably going to be his undoing.
Yeah.
And even during the writing, as people would read drafts, mm-hmm. People would come to him to try to talk him out of finishing the script. And of course, he was having none of it. Mm-hmm. And he would just drink more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in a way, Upton Sinclair has almost nothing to do with this movie. But oddly, Mankiewicz is doing his expose of a capitalist patriarch society. And with Citizen Kane, which most people would call, you know, so many people have it on their film list, especially from the 60s and 70s, as their favorite film. So it's always had this mystique of how did they write this? What was the war between Orson Welles, and how much did Orson Welles write? The article I had read many years ago, I had a book on called Raising Cain by Pauline Kael. And she had said that Orson Welles had nothing to do with it. And it was all Mankiewicz. And then people still argue about this. But I think the way this film handled it, we found out some really good insight between these writers and creatives. And I do think it's worth watching. I will watch it again, but I would recommend if you watch it, get a rainy day in the daytime with a cup of coffee and be alert, because it's really...
It's slow. It picks up towards the end.
It does. The ending is worth it.
Yeah, the ending is really quite good. Yeah. But getting there, we actually watched this in two parts. We faded the first effort at watching it. We faded.
Did. And it wasn't just because of the glasses of wine we had. Because there were people that who did not have glass wines. It may have contributed. But you know what? It was hard to follow the pacing. And I'm going to watch it again. But I'm going to watch it at like 10 or 11 in the morning one of these days and just, you know, analyze it a bit further. But it does look beautiful. It's gorgeous. And it is kind of you know what's funny about it? It's because it's a movie about movie making. So that's also kind of interesting on that. I think talking about this film is almost more interesting than watching the film, because there's so many movies about making movies.
Well, yeah, it sort of reminded me of the Tarantino film, the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes, absolutely.
And my criticism of it, aside from the pacing, is the same as the criticism I had of that Tarantino film. And that is, ho-hum, it's a bunch of Hollywood elites doing a film about Hollywood elites.
Oh. I know. And you know what? There's a huge tradition of that in Hollywood. Movies about movies are almost always about what are the motives of those actors? What are the motives of those filmmakers? Who are they? There's always a suspicion about art in most of those films, like The Player. There's so many. Inglourious Basterds might even be a movie about making movies because the film goes on fire. The Stuntman. Oh, I've got a list here somewhere, but there's so many movies about it, and it almost always does call into the... the ethics of the filmmakers? Because there's this suspicion that they must be bad because they're artists and they're creative types. So they must be suspicious. We can't trust them. They fool us, which they do fool us with propaganda.
Sure. I think with films made at this time, particularly after Me Too, which has really tainted the Hollywood scene, in which so many important Hollywood people are really complicit with, at the very least, knowing what Weinstein was up to and not saying anything.
Some people must have been. They must have been.
You know, I mean, surely to God they all knew. Mm-hmm. And they all let that happen. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you can be perhaps reasonably suspicious of the Hollywood community that way.
Yeah, there's a double thing going on, too, there with Weinstein as well, because I don't know if... Did you watch the Ted Bundy tapes?
No.
No, I don't think you would like it, but it's pretty grim. But they follow Ted Bundy and they interview... It's all the women. I think I talked about it a few months ago. They interview all the women that he attacked or that had survived or who knew him and worked with him. So it was really incredible to hear it from a woman's perspective. But what happened with Ted Bundy happened at the same time that women's rights were being mobilized. So in a way, the freedom that women were finally able to have in society also made them victims. And I think that might even be, we could look at Weinstein that way too, because there was such a feeling of like, I'm free in the world. How could it be dangerous? That's the old ways. Fatty Arbuckle, you know, the old ways of Hollywood Babylon are done. I'm a strong woman. I'm going to be a famous actress. I want to make a lot of money. And I think Weinstein was able to feed on that as well, in the same way that Ted Bundy fed on women's liberation and women's rights. you know.
Another film that I watched very recently, which I had avoided for the longest time, also in a way is about movie making.
Oh.
And that is Argo.
Oh, yeah, I love Argo.
In which, of course, they had a fake movie.
Yes.
A fake movie. It's a little bit hard as a Canadian to watch this film because the role of the Canadians was downplayed in it in order to, was sacrificed for the story and the thriller. And
yeah, I guess that's true.
And I think the American characters were glorified somewhat. And I know I've heard this criticism before, and I don't really know all the details of it, except to say that apparently all the trials and tribulations they had, like in the van getting to the airport, none of that happened.
Okay.
It was actually relatively smooth getting through. They were challenged at the airport. They got through it. They went.
Yeah,
but it had to become a more interesting story. But nonetheless, quite a good thriller. Very, very well made.
I love that movie. I thought, and Victor Garber is so good in it. And Ben Affleck is really good. I really loved it.
Yeah, so that's a 2012 film based on the 1979 events. And for those who don't know, during the revolution in Iran, when the American embassy was raided by the revolutionaries, and 66 American hostages were taken, but six people slipped out and took refuge in the Canadian ambassador Taylor's home. And the story is about getting them out.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Starring Ben Affleck, directed by Ben Affleck, also starring John Goodman and Alan Arkin, who provide comic relief.
Yes, they're
really hilarious.
They are hilarious.
And they do a great job in it. And Bryan Cranston is in it. Bryan Cranston is in almost everything, isn't he?
He was in it, yeah.
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 Yeah. He finds his way into an awful lot.
He does. I bet he's great to work with.
I bet he is. Yeah. And he seems to be almost never bad. He does a great job and just put everything that he does.
There's a few movies about movies that never are made. Sunset Boulevard is about movies that were never made.
Oh,
yeah. I don't know what some other ones are, but it's its own thing too about the fake out. It's about a movie, but it's and I guess Inglourious Basterds is about a movie that's not made too. In some way, yeah, I think so.
The other thing we watched in the last week, Sheila and I watched, was The Undoing.
Oh. Yeah, that looked juicy.
Which was a 6-episode series, murder mystery series. And I struggled with it some. I struggled with it at the beginning. I didn't think I'd be able to get through it.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, it's because I have a fairly low Nicole Kidman tolerance. I don't know what it is about
She's on the list, but
I just have trouble suspending my disbelief. Yeah. And so I did struggle somewhat with this movie. I thought that her co-star in it, Hugh Grant, did a stronger job in it. They did quite a good job. The series was kind of stolen, though, by the smaller role by Donald Sutherland, who at 85 is just still spectacular and has one of the most expressive faces, I think, in films.
I love him.
So it's a murder mystery.
Now I want to watch it.
Yes, it's about...
Don't tell me who did it.
I won't tell you who did it. It's about a couple and somebody that they know through the school, the private school they send their kids to. The mother of one of the other kids gets murdered, and the Hugh Grant character gets accused of the murder because it comes out that he is having an affair with
this
woman.
Of course.
And it's all about, did he do it or did he not do it?
I love it.
And I will say that it does get better. And the last couple of episodes I thought were quite strong. But getting into it was pretty difficult.
You know, that just reminded me, I didn't tell you, I don't want to interrupt you here on your train of thought.
That's okay.
But I forgot I watched Girl on a Train after we talked about it.
Oh, really?
And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah?
I really got into it. I maybe because I just didn't have a big expectation from our conversation, but I totally enjoyed it. It was one of those slick, you know, Gone Girl. I know, I love those. I love them.
Yeah, I haven't seen the film, but I did read the book, and I think I talked mm-hmm. about it. I had yeah. mixed feelings with
yeah.
the book.
Yep.
It was kind of okay,
yeah. Yeah.
But kind of not okay,
yeah.
too.
Yeah. So.
But worth reading. Definitely worth reading.
I wrote in capital letters here, one of my favorite movies about making movies, Singing in the Rain.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I could
yeah.
watch that endlessly, and that was a Robin Wood film, too, in that I audited in his course. Right back to, it always comes back to him and his film choices.
Sheila went to see Singing in the Rain not so long ago, and I think it was a production in which they had like symphony playing the music or something like that. It's something like, I don't know the details.
Right,
don't
just
remember.
To get people back in the theaters or something.
It was a whole production yeah. thing that was being done.
Yeah.
Kind of reviving that.
Right.
I didn't really
okay
that feel interested going. In going yeah. going to see it, but. Yeah. But she went with some of her friends yeah. and I think actually some of her friends took her out to that,
sure,
that film. She had a great time at it.
What about the museum issue that's coming up in Canada? Is it just in Canada or is it everywhere? About how museums have most of their collections in the basement, and we've sort of touched on this.
Yeah, I think there's an Auditor General's report. About that, criticizing specifically the McMichael collection
mm-hmm.
As having a large collection, none of which, only like a third of it's ever been shown.
Right.
And they're challenging the McMichael to justify their funding.
Wow.
If they've spent a pile of money acquiring work that they don't exhibit. And I am very much of two minds about this.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, fair criticism, right?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah.
I think they should show the work that they acquire, particularly if it's work of local Canadian artists, mm-hmm. which I think would be great if they could expose, mm-hmm. give some local artists some exposure.
Right.
It would be fantastic before bringing in the big money international shows.
Right.
But at the same time, I suspect that this kind of report is an attack on the museum community
mm-hmm.
at a time when the life of museums is very precarious throughout
yes.
the world.
Yes.
And this kind of attack could destroy museums. And it certainly calls to question, well, do we need these kinds of institutions? Do we need museums?
Mm-hmm.
Do we need the large public galleries?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that conversation is worthwhile, and it's going to have to come up from time to time. I'm going to say that the particular institution in question, the McMichael, over the past few years, mm-hmm. has had many excellent,
mm-hmm.
excellent shows. And in fact, we even acquired a painting after seeing it in one of the exhibitions.
Okay.
And it's a painting you can see upstairs by Colleen Heslin.
Mm.
There were two shows put together, one about Jack Bush,
mm-hmm.
and the other one was Colleen Heslin, whose work owes a lot to Jack Bush.
Ah.
They deal with forms in a similar kind of way, but Heslin has a totally different approach to putting together the, if you want to call them paintings,
mm-hmm.
In that the forms are actually separate pieces of cloth sewn together and stained in different ways.
Mm. That's interesting.
It's fascinating, so it's the way
textile
that...
textile.
Yes.
It's
been
well
definitely
as...
a whole part of that textile
yep.
history. Very, very strong work. And we were really entranced by the show
mm.
and we contacted the museum to see if, well, hey, is what's her gallery or any of these works available?
Mm-hmm.
And she did have a gallery out in Vancouver, and we were able to purchase one of her works.
Cool. Yeah, I've got two minds on this as well, because I believe that having art purchased for the public to view is extremely important. I also would like people to buy art and have it in their home from artists in the world as well. And I in that film, I talked about the I've got to find it again, the documentary that you thought you maybe watched it, and We're going to have to find out if you did or not, because it's got a lot to do with this. But Gerhard Richter was like, no, I don't want it to be bought for millions of dollars and hidden in someone's house. I want it to be in a museum. And the curator, the auctioneer, I mean, she was like, oh, well, he would say something leftist like that. Because the thing is, where can we share these things? Certainly something like, I think at some point, you know, historical paintings should be in museums. Because what were we talking about the other day? That people are getting a fetish. Someone like, you imagine Michael Jackson or Warren Buffett or somebody like that buying the artwork, and then they have it in a little room. I mean, where does stolen art go? Stolen art goes into someone's living space, and they secretly are looking at it. And it's gone perverted because it's not being...
As a painter, I'm fine with people having my work in their living room.
Yes, me too.
And in fact...
I want them
I'm... Sheila and I went to Montreal a few years ago to see an exhibition, and it was a fantastic exhibition by Anselm Kiefer.
Yes.
And there were paintings...
Love him.
There were paintings in this museum which were staggering in their size.
Yes.
I've never seen paintings this big.
I saw them
big.
In D.C. too.
They
yeah.
were just... I don't even know how to describe it. Ginormous.
Like three stories tall
or
something.
Yes, huge, ridiculously huge paintings that could only be exhibited in this kind of public institution. Mm-hmm. And as a painter, that caused me to think, even though I love those paintings, do I want to make paintings that... whose only home can be in an institution? Is that where I want my works to live?
Mm-hmm.
And part of the result of that is I started making smaller paintings.
Mm.
You might even call them easel paintings, because paintings that people could home, that people could live with, that didn't have to be in the giant museums.
Right.
Paintings that were modest in their scope that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. I mean, as it turns out, I sell very few paintings.
No matter what size they are.
Regardless of the size. So, you know, I mean, it's like less
you
cost
and
in
me
terms
both.
Of storage.
Right.
But curiously enough, very, very recently, I've started making some larger paintings again.
So, you know, you're not written in stone. Nothing has to be final. We can change our minds. Yeah. You know, I like to paint... 5x7 is probably one of my favorite sizes, you know, but it doesn't have to be large. I make paintings I like smaller, and definitely I see those paintings in people's homes. I think that I can't imagine who wouldn't want to brighten up their home with pictures of stars and caves and the Illuminati. I can't imagine. So, yes, but
which
I
reminds
also
me, after
yes,
this podcast,
yes.
I'm going to take you out to my studio. In the back of my studio, I have two of your paintings that you probably even forgot painting.
Oh, God, I'm afraid. I'm really nervous. Can I destroy them if I want
no,
to?
No, you may not.
They must be really bad if they're out in a shed outside.
They're not in a shed outside. They're in my studio.
Okay.
I like to look at them when I go to the studio.
Very nice.
Yeah.
I'm blushing. Oh, God. Singing in the Rain. Ed Wood. Here's my little list. Bowfinger. Cinema Paradiso. All About Eve. Scream. Tropic Thunder. The Life Aquatic. Oh, I love the movie Life Aquatic with Bill Murray.
I do not know that movie.
Oh, yes, you must see it. If you don't know it, we're watching it today. So
all
write
right.
that down. We have to watch it. Adaptation, which we've talked about on this bloody podcast many times because of Nicolas Cage.
Bloody fuck.
The Artist. Boogie Nights. Barton Fink, that's a good movie about making movies. The Player, The Stuntman, I think I mentioned that. Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, I forgot about that movie. I was trying to think so hard this morning. I woke up, you know, the unconsciousness wants to solve problems.
Yes.
And my unconsciousness wakes me up sometimes. It, you know, you're dreaming and you're solving problems. But sometimes it just shakes me awake and I have to get up and problem solve.
Well, also learning happens during sleep.
Yeah.
You know, I'm taking an online fiddle course, which is set up by a neurologist named Dr. Josh Turknit. And his workshop is teaching music. And one of the things that he says is that we don't learn as we're practicing. We practice, and then our brains absorb the practice we learn later, particularly at night.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things he suggests is, it's good to practice right before bed. And the other thing that he suggests is visualization. When you're lying in bed, before you fall asleep, visualize playing the music you're working on. Visualize the melody in your head, the progressions. Visualize your fingers hitting the notes, the strumming of the strings or the striking of the strings or the bowing of the strings or whatever instrument that you're playing. Do visualization, much like high-end elite athletes visualize jumping those hurdles or skiing the giant slalom or whatever. You do that visualization right before bed, and your brain works on it while you sleep.
Definitely.
And I think most people have experienced when they're practicing or trying to learn something and they get frustrated with it, and then the next day when they go back at it again, they find they can do it better.
Yes.
Right? And that's because your brain has worked on it overnight.
Definitely.
So when we say, I'm going to sleep on that,
We really mean it.
We really do sleep on it. Yeah.
We really do. And I think it goes with all kinds of things. Even when you're falling in love or you're feeling grief or you're feeling excited, I think visualizing, let me problem solve this. And, you know, I'm open-minded to problem-solving it. And you don't have to know how it's going to happen. You just, your unconsciousness will fix it. It wants to. It wants to remedy things. And we block all that shit in this world. But it actually, you know, that's why we don't like art. That's why we're afraid of art, is because it's the unconsciousness talking to us. You know? It's pretty cool.
Well, art could be pretty scary.
It's Antifa. Art is Antifa. Oh, how are we doing? We're getting...
I think we've done a podcast today.
All right. And together in the same room.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So tell us what you think about this podcast by emailing us at theagency.podcast@gmail.com or
The Agency, care of Anthony Stagg, at Post Office Box 89101, 1859 South Ashland Avenue, Chicago, Illinois, 60608.
And we'd love to hear from you. And I'd like to tell you that there still are one or two beautiful hip flasks.
In Canada.
In Canada, engraved with The Agency. You can order one up for $25 if we still have one left by the time you order. Or you can convince us to send you one if you have an extra super fantastic pitch.
Wow.
And maybe. You can get us to send you one. I don't know. Maybe.
So funny. You know, my friend Meg and I, we came up with this idea to write letters. We thought, let's have a business and write letters. This was before the internet. And we just thought, and so we put an ad in Now Magazine. And we called it Wishing Well Enterprises or something, that we'll write a letter, give us a topic, whatever you want, we'll cheer you up. We got one response. And a check for $25. And the guy asked for perversion. He asked for an Alice in Wonder erotic fantasy with shrinking and enlarging properties.
And did you?
No, I tore up the check. That was the end of our letter writing career.
I see.
But we thought we're going to be millionaires. Everybody loves mail. Well, everyone wants to get letters.
One of my favorite musicians, Mr. Joe Newberry, has an interesting offer for the holiday season. Mm. If you would like him to perform a song with a dedication as a Christmas gift for somebody,
he'll
do it, and you can pay him, I don't know, whatever it costs for the song.
And
he will do a dedication and perform a song for somebody, and you can send it to them for Christmas.
Isn't that a beautiful idea? I think it's so beautiful. What a beautiful, beautiful idea. Yeah.
I hope he's very successful.
I hope so too.
With that, I mean, Joe, like many musicians, are trying to find a way to be working musicians through the pandemic.
Yep.
It's something we talked about with Mars Holler as well.
Yes.
It's like, well, how do you find work when there's no audiences?
I know.
You know, and so you have to find other ways to reimagine the music business, I guess. On that note.
All right. See you.
See you next week.